It's my pleasure to introduce Anne-Marie Slaughter, the 2007 recipient of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation Medal in Law. The University of Virginia has no honorary degrees. This is attributed to Mr. Jefferson. He is reputed to have said something that precludes honorary degrees. I asked for a quotation and discovered that none could be produced. Nonetheless, we have no honorary degrees, and in consequence, the Thomas Jefferson Medal in Law is the highest honor the university can bestow. There are also Thomas Jefferson Medals in Architecture, and as of this year, in Civic Leadership. But they are secondary from our point of view. Anne-Marie Slaughter has been a pioneer in the cross-fertilization of the political science discipline of international relations and the legal discipline of international law. She teaches and writes on global governance, international criminal tribunals, and American foreign policy. She was born and bred, as they say where I come from, in Charlottesville. Her parents, Ned and Anne, are here, as well as I think a few other Slaughters. And welcome to you all. Anne-Marie received her bachelor's degree from Princeton in 1980, where she was in the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. She was awarded the Daniel M. Sachs Scholarship, which is a very high honor at Princeton and provides for 2 years of study at Oxford University, where she obtained the Phil degree in 82 and a doctorate in international relations in 1992, and in the meantime picked up a law degree from Harvard. She remained at Harvard for several years, completing her dissertation and working with Professor Abram Chase. Slaughter assisted Chase not only in some scholarly writing, but also in international litigation on various matters, including, for example, a challenge at the International Court of Justice to American military and paramilitary activities in Nicaragua. She joined the law faculty of the University of Chicago in 1989 and moved to Harvard in 1994 to assume a chaired professorship and eventually to become the director of graduate and international legal studies. In 2002, she returned to Princeton to lead the program where she began her academic career as dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Dean Slaughter Scholarship builds on developments in the world of international relations that began in the 1970s. In her apt words, that early scholarship began, here I'm quoting, began somewhat cautiously to unpack the state, traditionally the relevant and unitary actor in international affairs, to unpack the state into its constituent parts. Now, what that means is that in the dominant tradition of international relations scholarship at the time, scholars saw states as monolithic entities that pursued their own self-defined and often quite narrowly defined national interest with a kind of unitary identity. And the new scholarship began to look behind states and to recognize the internal domestic maneuvering that goes into deciding what policies a state will pursue. Moreover, as Anne-Marie has pointed out, a great many interactions occur across national boundaries that do not involve direct negotiations by the foreign ministries of governments. Interactions, for example, among parliamentarians or central banks, interactions among regulators of various industry, interactions among courts, interactions that in total mirror the transnational interactions of non-governmental organizations or the transnational interactions of private economic actors. In short, Slaughter was engaged in the conceptual disaggregation of the state. And disaggregating the state, the nation state, opens up possibilities for quite different and innovative understandings of what global governance might look like. We are not limited, she has argued, to a choice between, on the one hand, the anarchy of individual sovereign states jealously guarding their own authority in every respect, or on the other hand, of a hierarchical and highly regulatory world government. The former model of individual state competition on every subject is simply not tenable in a world where drug dealers, money launderers, intellectual property pirates, unscrupulous business enterprises, and terrorists of all sorts have their own global networks. And some coordinated response to those dangers is essential. But the alternative of a centralized and hierarchical world government is, in Slaughter's words, infeasible at best and dangerous at worst. Her contribution is to point our attention to a third approach. Her 2004 book entitled A New World Order describes this new model of international governance based largely on global networks of cooperation and information sharing. Networks that link government units of different states carrying out similar functions. So, for example, agencies that regulate securities or agencies that enforce antitrust laws have developed informal cooperative arrangements through international meetings and ongoing contacts. These networks help deal with sophisticated violators who might otherwise escape accountability and generate momentum toward more uniform or at least less inconsistent regulation. A virtue of these cooperative arrangements is that while they tend toward harmony and coherence, they do not impose solutions from above, and they leave key decisions to national actors. Now, there's been a good deal of controversy recently over the Supreme Court's reliance on foreign precedents and reaching constitutional decisions. I suspect the students remember discussing this in the 2003 opinion in Lawrence versus Texas, which struck down a law criminalizing homosexual sodomy. The court relied on a decision of the European Court of Justice, the European Court of Human Rights, which had reached the same result 22 years earlier. No Supreme Court decision, to my knowledge, has suggested that these foreign decisions are controlling, but their very citation has produced a noisy backlash, including a congressional resolution with 75 co-sponsors denouncing the very mention of foreign authorities as un-American. Anne Marie Slaughter may bear more responsibility for this than any other American, save perhaps the justices themselves, for inducing reliance on foreign decisions. She has been a prominent advocate of informal contacts among judges, leading to what she calls constitutional cross-fertilization. She first expounded these ideas in the Virginia Journal of International Law in an article entitled Judicial Globalization, and later elaborated and refined them in the New World Order. Dean Slaughter has done much to educate lawyers on international relations theory. Her work is marked by clarity of exposition, by comprehensiveness of coverage, and by mastery of the literature of two quite distinct and complex disciplines. And it also reflects the desire to bring theoretical insights to bear in intensely practical ways in addressing real-world problems in the international arena. Emery, we are very glad to have you here as the 2007 recipient of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation and Medal of Law. Please welcome Dean Slaughter.
Thank you. That's a wonderful introduction. I'd like to begin by dedicating this lecture to the memory of Mary Hoke Slaughter and Edward Ratliff Slaughter, Sr. For those of you who might not know, Edward Ratliff Slaughter, Sr. is honored by the building of the other Slaughter Hall at UVA, the Rec building. He was the assistant football coach and the golf coach and the head of intramurals. He devoted his life to this university, and they are very much with me in spirit. In 1823, Thomas Jefferson wrote to a Greek patriot about the Greek revolt against Ottoman rule. America, he observed, possessed, quote, the combined blessings of liberty and order. The phrase ordered liberty is generally attributed to George Washington's first inaugural address. People often talk about the American experiment in ordered liberty, and cite George Washington. He actually never used those words. He said he did counsel the United States to attend to the supporting values that make liberty possible, among them the eternal rules of order and right. But for ordered liberty, the closest I have been able to find is Thomas Jefferson in writing about the combined blessings of order and liberty. What Jefferson and his fellow founders meant was liberty under law. The order they were talking about was the order of the rule of law, backed by force, but essentially ordering a society through the mechanisms of law. They understood, as we are learning again today in Iraq, that although order without liberty is tyranny, liberty without order is chaos or anarchy and is equally destructive of human flourishing. They thought they were creating a country, a political system that would ensure liberty under law. I'd like to explore with you what we mean by liberty under law today, domestically, in our foreign policy, and above all, in the international system. So let's start domestically, this ordered liberty. What do we mean domestically? Well, the first thing that is striking when you read Jefferson or you go back to any of the Federalist Papers is that you read a great deal about liberty and a great deal about order. You read very little about democracy. Indeed, in the Federalist Papers, the principal mention of democracy is that Madison didn't like it. He describes democracy, by which he meant, of course, direct democracy, as a system of government that had failed, that it could work in a very small area, but even there, the Athenian Athenian democracy had not survived. So he uses it as a foil, and he says, instead, we are going to create a republic, a representative government, and he meant by that a what we would now call a liberal democracy or constitutional government or a democratic republic, which Jefferson's party, of course, were the Democratic Republicans. But what's the significance of his use of the notion of ordered liberty rather than democracy? It seems to me it's an idea that we forget today, and perhaps because we tend to use liberty and democracy almost synonymously when we're talking about our own system or around the world. But if you go back to the founders' understanding, what comes through very clearly is that democracy or representative government is a means to an end. It is not an end in itself. It is the means to the end of establishing liberty under law. What the founders sought was a society in which individuals could be free, but they could be free in a system that would not then invade the liberties of others, a system of ordered liberty. If you break that down today, what do we mean by liberty of law domestically? I think one way to think about it, and perhaps in honor of my grandfather, who was the golf coach, is a government that is up to par. Par meaning popular, accountable, and rights regarding government. That a system of liberty under law must have all three of those dimensions. We must have a popular government, an accountable government, and a rights regarding government. But then let's ask a little further. Popular government. Well, we think by that we mean, again, democracy. Universal suffrage, and certainly that's part of it. But of course, we don't mean one man, one vote. We know that. If you live in Montana, your vote has much greater weight than if you live in New York under the Senate. And indeed, most of our laws are often held up by the representatives of states with fairly few individuals. That was, of course, part of the constitutional bargain. So when we say popular government, we mean representative government. We mean government where everyone can vote, but we do not mean that all their votes are weighted equally. We actually mean a very complex set of negotiations whereby different states can coexist. And of course we know that the person who wins the popular vote does not necessarily become the president because of the electoral system. So popular government, meaning representative government, but subject to many, a spectrum of interpretations. Accountable government. Well, by accountable government, we generally mean government answerable to the people. But here again, there are many different mechanisms of accountability. We think of accountability to the people. But, of course, if you think about the ways the people exercise the power to hold the government accountable, to hold the government responsible for what it does and to shape what it does, there are countless mechanisms. There are fiscal mechanisms. So, of course, we use the tax system. We use law. We use delegation of authority to specific agencies, some of which are quite independent from any ability of the electorate to actually recall them. So we have a whole set of mechanisms by which we can hold government accountable, some of which are direct elections, and others, again, work through either the judiciary or through various means of delegation. And finally, rights regarding government. Well, from the United States, this seems pretty obvious. We look to our Bill of Rights. There it is. That's what we mean. A government that respects those rights is a rights regarding government. But if we broaden the discussion a little bit, in the first place, we, of course, are debating constantly what the scope of those rights are. Indeed, as Dean Jeffries just mentioned, Lawrence v. Texas, today, the question of whether or not there is a right to sexual orientation, or put it more commonly, a right to be free from discrimination based on sexual orientation, is very much in play. We are still defining the scope of those rights. If you look beyond the United States, you see economic rights, social rights, which we typically think are secondary to civil and political rights. We think we have the right to be free from government intervention. We have the right of free speech. We have the right of privacy. But we do not, we think, have a right to housing or a right to health care. That system has worked for us. It is also under debate in various ways. But if you look at South Africa or India, what you find are constitutional courts who are trained in the Anglo-Saxon legal tradition. They often have studied at great law schools like this one. And yet, they think it is possible to interpret a right to housing. There is a right to housing in the South African Constitution. Now, that does not mean, of course, that they mandate the government of South Africa to give every person a house. The government of South Africa doesn't have the means to do that. But it does mean that there are all sorts of constraints on the government when the government seeks to destroy housing or to adopt policies that would have the effect of destroying housing. There is, in fact, a way of enforcing a right to housing that makes you then wonder to what extent we have this divide between civil and political rights that can be enforced and economic and social rights that can't be. For other constitutional courts, they can be. I emphasize those different dimensions of what we mean by liberty under law at home because they become extremely important when we then think about what it means to stand for liberty under law abroad. And here again, I turn to another Jefferson quote. One of the wonderful things about being a Jefferson medalist is there is no shortage of material he spoke on just about every subject and he spoke very eloquently. So Jefferson, of course, before he was president, was Secretary of State. He was enormously worldly, traveled, and of course we know Monticello itself, aside from its name, is built on an Italian model. But he was very concerned with revolts and revolutions worldwide. I opened with his letter about the Greek revolt against Ottoman rule. And he welcomed the revolutions in France and also in Holland, which followed our own revolution. And he predicted, and again I quote, "This ball of liberty is now so well in motion that it will roll round the globe, at least the enlightened part of it. For light and liberty go together. It is our glory that we first put it into motion." So you have this image of a ball of liberty that would just roll naturally around the world, that we had put it into motion, we had set an example. He says it is our glory that we first put it into motion. But that once you've given it that push, it would just roll around to other countries. Well, it hasn't quite turned out that way. Although, if you look around the world, of course, Jefferson could never have imagined a world of 191 countries, but we have seen successive waves of democratization with the result that an extraordinary number of countries have at least embraced the notion of liberal democracy, and a remarkable number, at least if we compare where we are now in the world to 1945, say, or even 1980, there are far more countries that genuinely are liberal democracies. So that ball of liberty is still rolling. It encounters lots of bumps. But I give that quote because, of course, to Jefferson, it was unimaginable that we wouldn't stand for liberty under law in the world. That was as self-evident to him as the proposition that all human beings are created equal. That was what it meant to be America, was to stand for those values. Today, that is also a harder proposition in our foreign policy. We proclaim that we stand for liberty under law. Indeed, if you read President Bush's second inaugural address, he mentions the word liberty 34 times, and it is exactly a statement that America stands for liberty under law, that America stands against tyranny anywhere in the world, and that is our destiny. In rhetoric, it's very similar to many things that Thomas Jefferson wrote. It had a more forceful view of how that ball should be put in motion. It wasn't just a gentle push. It is a much more muscular view of actually encouraging democracy, removing governments that are not democratic. But it leaves us with the question of how do we stand for liberty under law abroad? The other view, the counter view to our foreign policy today, is that we should not stand for our values in foreign policy. That we should be a realist nation. We should pursue our self-interest as all other nations do. We should take care of ourselves, and we should let the peoples of other nations wend their way as they might. It is not our business to stand for liberty under law and to help other nations achieve it. I think there's a middle way. I suggest that the framework for liberty under law that I put forth domestically is a very good model for how we ought to stand for liberty under law internationally. I talked about governments that are up to par, popular, accountable, and rights regarding government. If we thought about all nations worldwide being required to be up to par, to be popular governments, accountable governments, and rights regarding governments, it is a much more nuanced approach than promoting democracy, by which we almost inevitably mean, even when we don't want to, elections with universal suffrage as soon as possible, without often the complicated compromises that in our own country mean some people's votes count less than others. Imagine if nations came together and developed an index of popular government, of accountable government, of rights regarding government, of ways actually to evaluate all governments along those dimensions, certainly including our own. I think it should be clear, if you just think about it for a minute, that we are not always up to par. If you think even about accountability and campaign financing, we have quite a ways to go. But imagine also what the global discussion would be. So when I presented this framework in Beijing, the leading Chinese foreign policy scholars liked the accountability part. They believe in accountable government. Indeed, they are having a very hard time holding local governments accountable to the center. Rights regarding depends on the definition of rights. But they actually thought the definition of popular government was great because they read it as, do your people like the government? And the Chinese don't have as free polls as we do, but they have pretty good polls, and I think it's fair to say that the current government is very popular. It's not surprising. The country is growing at a phenomenal rate. The people's standards of living are rising very fast. They see a brighter future. They see a country rising in the world and in the estimation of the world. So the Chinese reaction was, we're popular, that's fine. Just don't talk to us about democracy. Now that's not my definition of popular government, but once again, it does raise questions as to how one would actually compare nations on the measure of popular government, because surely a government that is liked by its people is better than a government that a country in which the government is actively oppressing its people and actively hated by its people. But it raises questions that have arisen in Afghanistan. Is a government that is where a leader is advised by a council, a shura in the Afghan tradition, of respected elders. If we take that model and we expand it, so it's not just respected elders, or if it is, it's respected elders who are also female elders and elders of many different tribes, is that a form of popular government? Why are we so certain that elections, universal suffrage elections, are the automatic key to popular government? Accountable government. As I said, there are many, many different mechanisms of holding governments accountable. If we were to develop a global index, we would once again have to think about what are the governments that are most responsive to the desires of their people. And in rights regarding governments, in thinking about rights regarding policies, we would have to take on board a much broader spectrum of rights. To have such a system and to stand for such a system as the United States, we would also have to subject ourselves to exactly that scrutiny. We would have to allow other nations to look at us, to take on board how popular our government is, how rights regarding it is, how accountable it is. It's also a far more nuanced approach. It allows one approach to China, another approach to Iraq, another approach to Afghanistan, depending where a country is on the spectrum of popular, accountable, and rights regarding government. So if we think about ordered liberty at home, the ball of liberty rolling around the world and how we might stand for liberty under law today, the final question we have to ask is, what does a system of ordered liberty look like in the world, in the international system? Well, recently, the United States has been very big on liberty and not so big on order. We have not embraced the international order, the order of rules and institutions that constitutes order in the international system. But traditionally, that kind of an order has served the United States very well. Initially, of course, as a young nation, we were a weak nation, as Jefferson understood very well, and we were, as all weak nations are, ardent champions of international law. Weak nations champion international law because they hope that it will protect them against strong nations. And when we were a weak nation, we followed suit. So when reading back through the Federalist Papers and other founding documents, there's a great deal on respect for international law. We then went through a period in the late 19th century where we were rather less respectful of international law. Certainly on the intervention side, we had our own colonies, and we rewrote a lot of the rules of international law, particularly in this hemisphere. But after 1945, we once again concluded that our interests as a nation, would be best served by building an international order that constrained us as well as constraining other nations. We built the United Nations, we built the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which of course is the precursor to the World Trade Organization, and the Marshall Plan, which gave rise to the OECD. We understood that as the most powerful nation in the world, what we were doing by building these institutions and accepting that their rules applied to us as well as to other nations were reassuring other countries that our power was not a threat, that we were willing to constrain ourselves in ways that they could rely on us, that they could be sure that, in fact, we would not simply use our power arbitrarily or in ways that made the world a more dangerous place. And for every increment of power that we gave up, we gained an increment of legitimacy. Harry Truman said, "No matter how great our strength, we all have to recognize that we must deny ourselves the license to do always as we please." One sentence encapsulation of the larger point. He said more generally that this was a very practical view, not an idealistic view of world government. Harry Truman was a very practical man. And he's talking about creating the United Nations, and he said if any nation would keep security for itself, it must be ready and willing to share security with all. In other words, we needed to create a system of collective security. After the Cold War ended, through the 1990s, as our power grew, both economically and militarily relative to other countries, we threw off many of those constraints. And indeed, many of those institutions need fairly radical updating to match or to counter the threats that we now face. On the other hand, in some ways, we proposed that maybe the world would be better off with a benign form of empire. And indeed, here again, I quote Jefferson, but I don't think he meant this phrase in the way that it has been interpreted by many in our government. He actually wrote about America as an empire of liberty. And there are those in writings about empire in the last 10 years where that phrase, the empire of liberty, has been taken rather literally with the idea that the U.S. power, unconstrained, would actually advance liberty through the world. So other nations should not worry about us. If it were an empire, it would be an empire of liberty. The question now is, what do we do in the world to reestablish a world of ordered liberty, to reestablish an international order that secures our liberty as a nation, but also the liberty of other nations, and that allows us to lead in precisely the way Jefferson envisaged, that allows us to reclaim a mantle of having stood for liberty, of having stood for democracy, for justice, for equality. Doesn't mean all nations are going to love us. All nations have never loved us, even when we have seen ourselves as very popular in the world. But it does mean other nations respect us and respect our values and believe that we stand for them. So I would like to close with a suggestion of 5 steps that the next president should take, whether that next president is male or female, Republican or Democrat. 5 steps to reestablish a world of liberty under law, a world of greater order, a world in which individual nations are also moving toward liberty under law. The first, I don't think you have to think hard, the first would be to close Guantanamo, as indeed our own Secretary of Defense would like, and indeed the President has said he would like. But there is no greater symbol elsewhere in the world of what other nations see as our hypocrisy than the existence of Guantanamo, the existence of a place where we hold individuals who have no legal rights, not the right under the U.S. judicial system or under the international legal system. They simply have no legal rights. for the rest of the world to stand for law, for liberty, for equality, for justice. It is a living contradiction. Second thing I would recommend is that the United States lead the world in combating global warming. Long term, the greatest threat to all of us is the very fundamental change of our planet. And I say this not simply because of deserts and flooding and rising sea waters, all the parade of horrors that we see increasingly and that our children are learning in schools as sort of a part of the world they live in, but also because of the conflict that is going to be unleashed as nations realize that their traditional lands are now turning into desert or are uninhabitable or underwater. That kind of change has always bred war, and it will breed war again. Nations will move, or nations will conquer territory, or nations will simply collide in their efforts to protect their own people. So it is a security issue as much as an environmental issue. But if the United States were actually to take the lead to say, you know, we're the world's biggest emitter, we're also the world's most powerful nation, we are going to take the lead in ensuring that all human beings worldwide have a planet that they can live on. We understand that decisions we make put other nations underwater. And if we don't understand that, it's being brought home to us because the decisions the Chinese are making are likely to put parts of our country underwater. So if we were to lead a global effort under law, under institutions, it would say a great deal about our commitment globally to the values we espouse. Third, we should seek reform of the UN Security Council, and indeed of all the international institutions that we created after 1945. We should lead by saying to the countries of the world, to the India, to Brazil, to South Africa, to Mexico, to the powerful countries that are rising in the world, it's time for us to make some room at the table. We understand that in 2020 or 2040, a world in which the Security Council is composed of five permanent members, France, Britain, the United States, China, and Russia, no India, no country from Latin America, no Muslim country, no African country, doesn't look like a genuine representative international order. If the United States were to take the lead in rewriting those rules, we would continue to benefit from the expanded representative rules that we would set up, rather than watch some of those institutions disappear and other countries write rules that we might be much less happy with. Fourth, we need once again to begin disarming, to accept the bargain of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, one of the most successful treaties ever concluded, if you think of how many countries could be nuclear if we didn't have that treaty. But that treaty was based on a bargain. It said countries that don't have nuclear weapons won't get them, and countries that do have nuclear weapons will start to give them up. The goal was complete disarmament, but certainly major, major, major reductions in existing stocks of arms. Now, George Shultz and Bill Perry and Sam Nunn and Henry Kissinger recently had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Quite striking. Henry Kissinger, who wrote his first book on the order created by nuclear weapons, now calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Very simple premise. If we are not willing to live up to our part of the bargain, other countries aren't willing to live up to theirs, and we are facing a world in which Iran has a nuclear weapon, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Japan, North Korea, South Korea, and on you go. The technology is there. And finally, we should join the International Criminal Court. We should renegotiate some of the provisions regarding U.S. soldiers, but we should accept that in a world in which we have one of the best military justice systems anywhere, and in which the International Criminal Court accepts that nations have the responsibility to try their own perpetrators of genocide or crimes against humanity or grave and serious war crimes, that the United States has nothing to fear from such a court and a great deal to gain. There is once again few more tangible symbols when I travel abroad of what other nations see as our hypocrisy, that they see us championing the rule of law, standing for international criminal justice against terrorists, against perpetrators of genocide, against perpetrators of crimes against humanity, but we're not willing to have that rule of law extend to us. So close Guantanamo, lead on global warming, lead on Security Council reform and reform of other international institutions. Once again, lead the world in fulfilling the bargain of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and joining the International Criminal Court. What all those things have in common is that we as a nation would be willing to restrain ourselves through law. We would be saying we seek to enjoy our liberty as a nation, but not at the expense of other nations. That is both counterproductive and frankly dangerous, because when we do not restrain ourselves, other nations band against us. But those steps of restraining ourselves under law, are also consistent with our deepest values. They are entirely consistent with the values that Thomas Jefferson and his fellow founders thought they were building into the very fiber of this nation. I close with another quotation. I will not sing it, if only for fear that my father might join in. Everyone sings the first verse of America the Beautiful. We all know, for spacious skies and amber waves of grain. Very few people sing the second verse, but the second verse is very instructive. It says, O beautiful for pilgrim feet whose stern, impassioned stress, a thoroughfare for freedom beat across the wilderness. America, America, God mend thine every flaw. Confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty in law. Thank you.